MiningWeb Weekly. Well, we watch our analytics quite carefully. It seems every time you talk about gold, more people want to know where we are. Gold's at $4,000 an ounce, just below there. Not a lot of excitement there, but boy, has Peter Major got interesting stuff to tell us about today. So I've got to let you into a little bit of a secret here, Pete. When I was at the Citizen newspaper, now we're talking about 1980. Okay, when I started in financial journalism, I had a guy who I worked with only for 1 month. He was our mining editor. His name was Charles Smith. And Charles and I became fast friends, and we are today. Anyway, Charles is in, he moved out of journalism. He moved into the public relations world, and he's made quite a good business for himself. But one of his businesses that he represents, and I don't know whether I've got this absolutely right, but I think he was never being paid, but he was going to receive a benefit if Steenkamp's kraal ever managed to make it across the line. And he's been at it for decades, literally decades. And he keeps telling me what a wonderful project this is. And so this week I got a press release from him to say that Steenkamp's kraal is now on its way. It's got IDC funding. His ship has come home. He didn't tell me that. But knowing him, and we're such good friends, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this about him. But he really has worked on it for a long time. Is Charles going to be a rich man? Has his ship come home?
You know, Alec, when you take a long-term bet, you got two big risks. One is, are you going to live long enough to receive the winnings, right? Because it could be 45 years like this is. The other risk is the person that owes you, are they going to live long enough to pay you? So, you know, those are two risks. And so who did Charles expect to get paid from? Are they still around?
I don't know. He's still doing their PR, so I presume.
He's still around. So his side of the bet's okay. Now he's just going to make sure whoever he bet and has the money and they're still around. But when you talk mining, you're talking decades, unfortunately. Whether you start out or not, you end up being decades. You know, who would have thought when gold peaked at the end of 1980, early 81, that it was going to be falling for literally 23 years straight? You know, nobody could have guessed that because they went out and bought a lot of mines. And if you look at O'Keefe Copper, we've spoken to about on this program before, O'Keefe pulled the plug on copper mining literally at the lowest gold price in the history of man. It was towards the end of 2003.
And they pulled copper price.
Lowest copper price we've ever seen. It wasn't even that low in the Great Depression of the 30s. So O'Keefe decided to close right in 2003, the lowest copper price ever. And literally the next day it started up and it kept going all week. It kept going all month, but they were already stripping. They had the cutting torches there, knocking down the head frame, selling the hoist to Black Mountain. The copper price kept going up. It didn't stop. I think it finally peaked in 2008. So literally 5 years solid, every day it went up from the day they decided to close. And there's another famous mine that closed on that same day. The second lowest gold price in the history of man was Homestake Gold Mine. And that was the biggest, richest mine in all of North America, the oldest mine. It had been listed on the Dow Jones for about 130 years. And Barrick closed it at the end of December on just about the lowest gold price we'd ever seen. And had they just left it open another week, another month, it would have been back in the money. And Homestake produced 40 million ounces, and they claimed they had as much left down there. So, yeah, timing is everything, but mining is long-term. It's often decades, not just years.
I remember a similar story with Patrice Motsepe, where he came into my studios at the, into the studios at the SABC. I don't know if you remember those radio studios down in the dungeons. The SABC created them that way in the old regime because if they got bombed, well, at least they'd be able to talk from the dungeons, from the under the subterranean.
Yeah, because the bad guys always take over the radio station first when they invade. So you're right. Hide them out.
Well, I tell you what, to get through those catacombs would have been quite the achievement for anybody who took over South Africa. But I remember Patrice Motsepe coming in, this young lawyer who had, well, he came from a pretty good, wealthy family, I believe. But he came in there, spoke to me about how he was going to take over deep level mines from Anglo Gold. And the gold price at the time was around, well, it was under $300 an ounce anyway. And my goodness, what a bet that was from his perspective. He put it all on the line. So good for him. Good for him.
Yeah. You know, right place, right time. And he did the right thing.
I also remember Brett Keble. Do you recall around about $290 an ounce going short or hedging out his gold at that time? Just the worst possible bet. That Brett or anybody could have made, again, getting the timing wrong.
And what's odd there, Alec, is he was so bullish on gold all through the 90s that it shows he wasn't quite walking his talk. And, you know, I think he was bullish, but you get in a bind and it was easier to make money by selling forward, easier to make money by selling short. But all he did was burn on his shorts from the time he started selling them because it was going against him. So his innate thoughts on gold were correct. I remember sitting around dinner tables, lunch tables, listening to him talk, and he was a very eloquent speaker, and he spoke logic. And virtually everything he said why gold should go up was correct. But it was very similar to the things that Alan Gray himself personally was saying in 89-90. They were correct, but Alan was 15 years too early, and Brett was about 10 years too early.
And it gets back to Charlie Smith's story about long term, but at least he's lived to see the day, I believe, anyway, or hopefully it's coming pretty soon. Mining's full of those kind of stories, though, people selling at the wrong time. When they take that decision, is it a result of just giving up patience, just losing when the finishing line is in sight, but they don't know the finishing line is there? You think of the Menel family selling out the AngloVol mining assets in the DRC. Remember that cobalt operation, Lubumbashi, at the absolutely worst possible time to some guys from Eastern Europe who made a fortune out of it.
It very often is, Alec, that the person still believes in it, but they just can't hold on any longer. They just can't make the margin call. They can't make the next payment due, and they let it go very reluctantly. But sometimes they let it go in a fit of frustration because Patrice Motsepe's firm, they let go of that copper asset that Rick Menel had put tons of money into, that they put tons of money into. I think they put close to $400 million into that Zambian copper asset, and they let it go right at the bottom, and they gave it to the Australians at a very good price and terms. And the Australians, I think, were in the money within 2 months, you know, and that was just bad timing. And I think they simultaneously gave back their chrome assets to Associated Manganese, whose original chrome asset it was. And 12 months later, Asmain was bragging up, they made enough money to pay for the capital they used to buy it back. So that was, we don't know if that was a change of tack. I know Patrice said it was a change of strategy. Those were strategic decisions. But strategic usually means bad decision made without prudent thought.
Mm-hmm. And so, mining is just...
Sometimes it's pried out of their assets. When Metarex got rid of O'Keeffe, they weren't burning. You know, I think O'Keeffe still made money the last year in 2003. But they had a very good ore body in the DRC, and they were bragging to the press, Simon Malone bragging to Martin Creamer, hey, we've just saved 150 million rand by stripping this old mine and trucking it up to the DRC. But anybody who's driven a truck to the DRC, that's like driving halfway to the moon, you know, and by the time you get up there, you want to have some pretty good equipment, not old 100-year equipment that was designed for an underground mine. You're going to try and make it fit a brand new open pit mine with different types of ore. very different type of ore. Within 12 months, all that equipment was thrown in the jungle. They took out a big loan from Standard Bank, and they bought fit-for-purpose brand-new equipment. So they killed the mine for nothing.
Peter, something that came out this morning, I haven't had a chance to kind of check you out on this, but maybe you know about it because it's in Idaho. JP Morgan has just bought a mine, JP Morgan, in Idaho that makes antimony, or rather mines antimony. Now, remember antimony from a mine in South Africa called Consolidated Murchison. What is antimony, and why would this suddenly be a something that a big bank would be interested in?
Well, it's an alloy that's used for hardening, like vanadium. It's used for certain lubrication. It's fairly toxic. So when you have a mine or an ore body that has antimony, the EPA and all the health authorities have a very strong view of it. You know, are you treating it well, especially the refining? And it's difficult. So a lot of the mines in Idaho, especially the silver mines, they had antimony as a byproduct. And Sunshine Mine, world's richest silver mine, all of a sudden got $50 million, and they started hiring everybody in the valley this summer. And nobody knows exactly where the $50 million came from, but the word is it came from Department of Defense. Because, yes, China, it's a fairly toxic mineral, but it's very well needed in military applications and other heavy industry. And so the U.S., they even closed the Sunshine Antimony plant, recovered it as a byproduct 20 years ago. So just like rare earths, we've allowed China to fill the gap and mine all these toxic, difficult to refine minerals and sell them to us in a refined state. But now with trade battles going on, we realize we've got our neck in quite a few nooses. You know, we're hogtied. So
when you say we, you're talking about the Western world, not South Africa.
That's right, the Western world. South Africa's lucky. We can get our minerals out of the ground here, just about all of them.
Mm-hmm. But what is this antimony? And where's Cons Merch? Is it still around?
Consolidated Murchison is around, and it was a bit of a bonus because you got 3 to 4 grams a ton of gold with your antimony. So you and I were at the Indaba a few weeks ago, and I was trying to pin down, do the Australians who bought Consolidated Murchison about 6-7 years ago, do they still own it? Are they running it? And funny enough, we were asking everybody there, and up popped Hugh Grant from Anglo American. And he said, my wife's from Consolidated Murchison. I used to work there. That's where I met her. But we still couldn't trace who has it today. Is it running? Because, boy, with 3 to 4 ounces a ton of gold, you don't even need the antimony in it. But it was a very rich antimony mine. So whoever owns that now should be making double whammo profits on antimony and gold.
That's a little bit of an inside joke there from the Joburg Indaba. Hugh Grant is the scale nom, or the nickname that they give to Duncan Wanblad, the chief executive of Anglo American, because apparently he looks like Hugh Grant. He has film star looks. Isn't that the story, Peter?
Very much, yeah. How he keeps that youthful look, we'd like to know, with all the pressure he's supposed to have.
Something else that was mentioned a number of times at the Joburg Indaba, and I don't understand it. I've met a couple of chrome miners who are grumbling. Is this chrome tax? Please unpack that for us. What exactly is going on there, and why is government wanting to put a tax on exports of chrome?
Well, we can't blame that on Donald Trump, because this government was talking about a chrome tax before Donald Trump was elected. But I think he's made taxes and tariffs quite popular. In other words, people that want to bring in foreign goods have to pay a tariff. Well, this is like a reverse tariff. If you want to export your material, you're going to pay a 25% tariff to the government. And the government's going to take that money, and they're going to allocate it correctly in the right places. So they tell us. Although we've seen their track record for the last 30 years, the way they allocate money. So most of us are quite wary of government taxing all the current chrome producers 25% on the value of their chrome exports. And if anybody is livid, it's platinum mines that have spent a lot of money on R&D figuring out how to recover the chrome out of their fines that have been there for 60, 70, 80 years. Now they finally perfected how to do it, and they found a market for those fines. And now, are they going to be required to pay 25% tax? Because nobody else wants to buy those fines but the Chinese. And the Chinese have been so advanced and aggressive in smelter technology and design that they can now process fines just about as well as they did the traditional lumpy ore that sells at a premium.
Fines?
So, the fines.
What are the fines?
The fines, we know what tailings ponds look like, right? After you've ground everything up in the large ball mill and the waste is separated from the high-grade metal, those fine sands are deposited in those enormous tailings ponds. And for decades, people were saying to the platinum mines, why aren't you removing your chrome from there? There's a lot of chrome in there. But they couldn't be bothered. It was technologically very difficult, very expensive. They were making good margins just taking out the base metals and the PGMs. But with tough times, especially in the 90s and some of the early new millennium, they kept working on it. And now they've got the recovery techniques very commercially attractive. And so they're our biggest single exporters of chrome ore now are the platinum mines out of this very fine product that was totally discarded, total waste, and now it's bringing in real revenue.
But our government wants 25% of it.
They want 25%. They said they will help support the chrome smelters we once had and the few existing ones. I think we got 12 out of 60 that are operating. And I don't know if they're operating at capacity or not. But they're not under pressure and closing chrome smelters because of our exporters. They're closing our chrome smelters because our electricity prices have gone up, 9 or 10 fold in 20 years? Because our infrastructure, as far as highways and especially railroads, has really, really fallen apart. And labor, is our labor's productive? No, our labor is not as productive as it was before. And I won't pick on us because American labor has never been more unproductive, according to the big gold miners there. So these are the reasons. And also, China can run cheaper smelters on their technology, but China's electricity costs is a third less than ours. You know, we used to be way ahead of the world on economic and reliable electricity. So government's got to take the rap for the majority of this. And now they say, well, we'll just tax the people who found a way around it, and we'll give that money back to the smelters. Well, I don't know if that's going to make us
social engineering. It's quite interesting that the Chinese kind of got the fact that electricity is what makes you a competitive economy. But other parts of the world seem to forget that, because we've seen the Western world, and even here in South Africa, moving towards a very expensive green energy transition, dumping the cheap ways to generate electricity and then bringing in, because it's good for the climate, it's good to attack climate change, bringing in other ways. The problem, I suppose, with all of that is if only some of the world is doing it, well, you are going to be at an economic disadvantage, and you're not really going to make that much of an impact, because the part of the world that isn't doing it is going to grow faster and just take over more of the economy and do more pollution and so on. And that appears to have been, if you look at the contrast between the UK, for instance, which is, sure, it's paying very heavy energy prices as a result of its transition, and China, which, as you've told us now, is cleaning up South Africa's ore smelters because they're a third of our electricity costs.
Yeah, the manganese smelters, the chrome smelters. I doubt Palabora's, that's our only copper smelter. I doubt it could compete with the Chinese copper smelters. They're now offering free tolling to the world. Send us your concentrates. We will treat them for zero cost, and you get your metal back. Now, they will make it out of the byproducts, and some government subsidies. But see, if you've got a very rational, logical, clearly focused government, they can run these things in parallel structure. They can say, we know coal is dirty, but it's cheap. It will electrify all of China. So we're going to burn more coal because it's the cheapest electricity. But each coal plant we build, we will make it burn cleaner and cleaner and higher temperature. And China leads the world in low-grade coal boilers that emit less pollution and can burn a lower grade of coal than anybody else in the world. See? So, and simultaneously, they want to be the cheapest windmill producers. They want to be the cheapest, and they are solar panel producers. And simultaneously, they're building not just the cheapest nuclear reactors, but thorium reactors, breeder reactors, and now they're working on a hydrogen fusion reactor. So they're using the money they make, the taxes they charge, to pursue futuristic technologies. So they're going to beat everybody because they're doing this in a logical manner rather than what you said, Alec. Some politician just writes in Europe, we're going strictly to clean energy, cost irrelevant. Well, you pay the price as a country. You lose your heavy manufacturing, your big energy users, and you probably can't get it back. It goes to China.
Getting back to the chrome tax, is this a done deal or just a proposal?
It's a proposal. And let's hope that's as far as it gets. And then government could say, well, we proposed it. We tried to help the guys out, but the public was against it. Big business was against it. And a lot of people say, who's going to allocate this tax? Is it going to go to favorite cadres? Is it going to go to each politician's personal wet dream? You know, who's going to allocate the tax? Like all government money, how's it getting allocated? Who's going to oversee the allocation? And was it thought through? We've seen so much bad legislation here, especially on mining, because there's never an adult in the room when these policies are formulated. The people don't think more than one step. Okay, what'll be the immediate reaction to this bill? And are there other reactions further down the road we haven't anticipated? What are the consequences of these bills? So I don't think it's going to get passed, Alec. It's been raised too many times when we had more smelters and China was taking less of our chrome ore, but now they're taking so much. We're so dependent on them. We're producing record amounts of chrome that I don't think the government will pass this bill.
Still staying with the government, we have another topic that came up quite a lot at the Joburg Indaba was exploration. We do sit in a place where it just seems obvious that you can leverage the minerals in the ground, but if you get someone to find the right places to mine them or the best places to mine them, you then have an opportunity. But exploration, what I heard there, hasn't happened here for 20 years. Is that true? Has no one been exploring for 20 years? And secondly, where do we go to from here if we had a government that realizes that you can't build on a mining sector that is declining if you're not exploring because it is a wasting asset?
Well, without a doubt. But I would say roughly our exploration spend has probably been on like a 45-degree downward slope continuously since the early 90s. And there's just nothing we see in the legislation to change that. And It's scary and sad that in 2003, 2004, when we came out of the longest slump in metal prices, and we're still part of this super cycle that's now been going on over 20 years, it has not deterred that downward slope in exploration spend in South Africa. So it means it's irrelevant to metal prices. We can no longer blame failure to build new mines, failure to do exploration, failure to modernize mines and processes. We can't blame that on metal prices because we've had raging metal prices the last 20 years. So what is it? It can only be policy. So we do need exploration. The best place to explore is usually right next to where you're mining. But mining houses, they're not even exploring around their existing mines very much, certainly not the deep level mines. because what good is it to find ore next door that's very deep? That means you have to sink another shaft. And we haven't seen a gold mine shaft sunk here in 20 years, and not one mine has a plan to. So mining companies are saying, there's no commercial reason for us to ever sink a shaft here. You know, the way the legislation has gone, policies. So there's no way we would sink a shaft, even if we found an ore body next to us. So why do we need to explore? And we sure don't need to explore 10 kilometers away, 100 or 1,000. Because we're not going to start a new mine here, even if we find something. And people have tried, and that makes it even more difficult to get exploration funding now, Alec, because a lot of people have tried to fund exploration in this country, and they've waited so long for their licenses, or they found their licenses finally came back with big chunks cut out, where some other mysterious applicant, just happened to beat you to the punch. There's just so many reasons that you're on a hiding to nowhere spending money on exploration. And it's never been a small man's game. It's risky as hell for small companies to explore because it's all money going out and you have no idea if you'll find something, how good it'll be, how economic it'll be. You don't know how long it'll be before you can raise money to develop it. So your only recourse is to sell it to some large person, probably at a huge discount. Now, large companies, they have found there's so many little juniors out there exploring that they can cut out their exploration departments by 75%, and they can pick what they want out of who they want at a pretty good price. That they found all these juniors out there will yield them ore bodies cheaper and more reliably than when they had these own house large exploration divisions like we used to. And we were set up for 100-year mining trends in this country. You know, these mining houses, they had databases, they had huge teams. O'Keep Copper, that was one mining company. They had 150 people in the geology department, you know, surveying, exploration. They had 60 drill rigs in-house, 30 underground, 30 on surface. You know, these were O'Keep. If you look at the files they have, how much exploration they did. But see, there was an incentive to do it. What you found, you got. You might have to negotiate with the landowner, but generally they were rational. And we removed all these incentives. And if I can add something, because I got a couple calls from KwaZulu-Natal. One of them came direct from Dundee. And he appealed to me to mention this on your show. I should have cleared it with you first. He said, Peter, you and Alec are talking how hard it is to get these prospecting rights and mining rights. Let me tell you, there's 30 new rights granted in the Dundee area in less than 2 months. 30 brand new mining and exploration rights. It's a madhouse out here. It's all the Zama-Zama types. They're undercapitalized. They don't have proper equipment. There's no rehab going on. There's no consulting with the landowners. They're plowing over people's fields. They're opening old tunnels with acid mine going down the river. And there's no management of this at all. And that is a contrast that we heard at the mining indaba, Alec, is the wrong licenses are going to the wrong parties.
I remember something similar happening in the Klerksdorp area, where there were all kinds of diamond miners that were going nuts there, especially the farmers who were just finding parts where they felt there were diamonds and churning up the fields. Well, it has to be. It obviously has to be properly managed. And Dundee is very close to my heart because it's close to where I grew up in Newcastle, just around the corner. It was such a pretty area. It is a beautiful area. But I guess what you're saying now, what are they looking for there? Is it coal?
Yeah, it's all coal. Because coal, you need the least capex to dig some out, put in your truck, and sell it. And that's what our coal industry has, hundreds and hundreds of miners here that nobody can keep track of. Nobody can manage them, see are they doing rehab, are they doing consultation, public participation. And they found a quirk in the system, and the government even changed the quirk to make it better, that you don't have to fulfill all the requirements if you get a coal permit instead of a coal license. You can fast track the water use license. You can fast track the rehab, even the public participation process. So the government's tweaking this, trying to make it better for small miners. But we've discussed long enough, small miners are not an asset to the country. They're they're worse than an impediment to proper development. You know, they're a menace. And so, yes, they're all opening old abandoned coal mines. They're already pretty well mined out. And they're probably making, if they make $5 a ton, I'd be amazed, because coal prices are quite low now. And you add up all those zamas, they'll probably not do 5,000 tons a month for all the damage they're going to incur. And you get one medium mine that can do 40,000 tons a month, 40-50 underground. And nobody will even know it's operating. You'll see a little bit of refuse on the dump, maybe some trucks going out. So that's the difference. You know, a proper mine disturbs very, very little of nature compared to many, many improper mines that are just ransacking the countryside.
Well, I've warned you that I need to get more information now on Zunaid Moti and Mike Miller. It took an interesting turn. Zunaid Moti got hold of me. He said, this Mike Miller calls me a criminal, says I run a criminal enterprise, says that Paul O'Sullivan's a sellout. I want a right of reply. And he was actually prepared to pay us, would you believe? And I said to him, no, that's not the way it works. You have a right of reply. That's where we are. We are a platform. We give both sides of the story. So he then came on and we had a very interesting chat yesterday where he went through Mike Miller's background. And he started off saying, this guy is a chartered accountant, and be careful, Marcus Yuster was as well. He said, then he's a game ranger. He's not a miner. He's a game ranger who's now become a corporate poacher. And I think he kind of gave himself a little smile, which was a nice turn of phrase. But this thing is turning ugly, and very, very ugly. And I don't know, given that it's in the mining sector, I don't know that who's right, who's wrong. Is Moti good? Is Moti bad? Is Miller actually a game ranger who's just trying to pull a fast one? What's your take on all this?
Boy, the more time I spend looking at the two people and the two companies, I don't side more with one over the other. I'm probably really stuck in the middle. And I always say, when you're in the middle, you don't want to invest. You don't want to go long. You don't want to go short, because it's too easy to get the wrong side. But both of them, first of all, Mike's traded in listed companies, but it's the small cap sector. And that is such a tricky, difficult sector. It's very difficult to analyze. And I try analyzing the current company. Yes, there's tons of assets in there that could have a value of $1 billion, but it's not reflected in the market cap. And is the market that stupid? And when you see earnings go up from 1 cent last year to $1.37, does that really deserve headlines, or is that an accounting trick? And the basics that I grew up with, Warren Buffett era in the States in the 60s and 70s. And my investment starting out in South Africa was with Alan Gray and then with the Seyfrith Coronation people. And we always came back to earnings. Earnings support share prices. Headlines might make those share prices go up or down, but they won't keep them up or down. Earnings are what keep them up or down. If you're not making any money, the weight of those earnings or non-earnings will drive your price down. If you're making money, those earnings will push that share price up. So I don't know how much short selling has to do with the current share price. And I'm kind of a free market capitalist. I almost think people should be allowed to go naked shorts, because if you're wrong, you'll get cleaned out real quick. You know, so I worry the government put so many restrictions on them. I think they're protecting the wrong people. I think if a guy wants to take a naked short, let him. He's got to borrow the script from someplace. He's going to pay a lot of money to borrow it. And boy, if he's long, or if he's wrong, that's tough luck. So, yeah, I could go through these financials, and I did. And I'm probably the worst financial analyst in the country. But as a mining analyst and a mine manager, I see lots of assets there, but I know how much money it costs to bring assets to book. And Mike says, we're not going underground. We can make plenty of money on these tailings, on these dumps. And you can, you know, Jubilee did, Sylvania did, but they put up a lot of money and hard work capital to become a regularly profitable dump retreatment operation. So I worry that Montangu might be focusing on too many areas. look, I don't know the company that well, but there's a lot to cover. It's easier to go through an Anglo-American annual report and figure out how they make their money and what their asset value comes from. You know, there's a multitude of assets in this that are worth way more than the market cap of $11 million. But O'Keeffe Copper, Prieska, you know, figure the copper in the ground. It's 10 to 20 times what the market cap is. But the market's not dumb. It doesn't often get things wrong. The market knows mining takes longer. It takes more capital. And look at poor Copper 360. You know, how you fund your operation is very important. If it's all equity funding from big shareholders, fine. And I know Montagu is, I think they've more than doubled their shares in issue. They tripled them since the beginning, you know, from 150 million shares, they're up to about 300. Okay. So, but is it only equity? Is it debt? Because Copper 360 got into a lot of exotic funding vehicles, and they are ruthless. They make loan sharks look like your best friend. And, you know, and I've seen these small cap companies go up to London. I forget the name of the type of brokers they get money from, but they have to give those brokers shares at a discount. The brokers then sell those in the market, and then they loan you some of the money that they've got from that, and they keep the rest. So they've made money from day one under the radar with no risk. They're only loaning you money that they got by selling your shares. So I don't know where all the money's coming from, Montagu, and I don't know Mike's plan, but I would say narrow it down to what's going to generate earnings the fastest. And if you're trading at 60 cents and you can show 6 cents, that's a 10 PE. Show 10 cents. You know, you're down to 7 or 8. Now you can even pay a dividend. But you can't expect your supposed NAV to support the share price. And if someone's shorting it, you know, is the JSE responsible to find out who it is? You know, prove the guy wrong by making some money.
Yo, it does remind you of so many other instances, and Marcus Yuster played that game. He played, well, I can't say that game, but he played a game where he was fooling everybody by putting fictitious numbers into the accounts. But the most famous example of this, I remember Dave Shapiro and I were, we were in the Classic FM studios when we used to do the show on Classic, and Gary Porritt came into the studio and had a chat with us about Tigon. And when he left, David Shapiro said, oh, he's interesting and he talks a good story, but he's got to be a magician because the numbers that he's talking or the growth that he's telling us about is not, I can't see it. I can't see where the cash is. There is no cash. And what he was essentially saying was that he did not believe, he did not buy the story. Because where's the money? And I guess that's what Mike has to do. He has to show the money.
Yeah. And Mike's got a good opportunity to show he's not a Jeffrey Liebsman. He's not a Gary Pollitt. He's not a Marcus Yuster. He does have assets in that company. They're real assets. And it depends what terms and conditions he got those assets. Who does he really owe? Are they fully paid and clear? You know, what interest rate is he used to fund them? They're massive assets. And we know you can make money off dumps a lot cheaper than you can going underground. He says he's in no rush to go underground. So he has the assets under there, but he needs funding to realize value out of those assets, to make them start churning out cash. And if I look back to the original Brett Kebel, that was starting about my days at Allen Gray in 89. And my first job at Allen Gray was to analyze the hell out of Conn's Mining, Brett Kebel and Co., and Egoli and Southco, because all those shares were trading at 50, 60% discounts to the value that we perceived them to be. And I did that for nearly 2 years, and that discount would not close on Egoli. And it was a year or two later, when I moved across over to Seyfritz, that they started unbundling those assets. You know, Brett took them over and says, I'm going to realize value. And as they unbundled them, we found out there was big debt that nobody knew about, that nobody could trace, but it showed the market is the sum of all knowledge. So the market, there was no one person in the market that knew all that data, but the sum of what everybody knew in the market warranted those shares trading at a 50% discount because of that risk. And so Mike's got to prove, you know, those were real companies, Egoli, Conn's Mining, et cetera. The problem was they didn't have working capital to develop them. And a bigger problem they had was the metal prices were horrendous in the 90s. You know, gold down there below 300, rampant inflation here, the union's getting perpetual double digits. You know, everything was against mining really here in the 90s. And our industry held up pretty well. But new companies, undercapitalized companies, small companies, they're always at risk, and they couldn't sustain that. The big mining companies did really well handling the 90s.
Well, there's a big story there that is developing. Zunaid Moti's side of it, I don't know if you got the chance to listen or to watch that interview. He went into quite a lot of detail.
He did. I don't know if he did that himself or he had his staff do it, but those are all, I think they were facts. You know, all those numbers, they're factual, and I'm sure there's an explanation behind it. And that's where accountants can leave mining engineers in the dust. You know, mining engineer just sees the number and he derives something from it. And the accountant will say, yes, it looks bad, Pete, but here's why it's not as bad as you think it is. And often there is a story behind it. But Mr. Moti raised very illuminating questions and numbers there.
What a fascinating country, what a fascinating city Johannesburg is. And in many ways, what a fascinating place the Johannesburg Stock Exchange is, because often I've heard it described as, well, it's still a mining camp. And sometimes the behavior of the participants would suggest that they are like those forefathers who made Joburg more than 100 years ago. But it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tough. Experienced people, but dare I say, they are playing in a big man's game. Mining is a big man's game, just like building automobiles, just like going into space. So no matter what our government tries to tell us that they're opening up the sector to the individual, they're not doing any individuals favors. There were a lot more jobs when the big guys were there with well-capitalized balance sheets. They offered real jobs. Anglo's had 1 million employees at its peak. Every one of those employees could go to a bank, get a loan, because they worked for a real company and they had surety of income. But yeah, small people, if they want to venture in there, that's fine. And maybe one out of 10 will make it. But the odds of small caps, if I can give one more boring story, Alec, if you remember 1999, at the start of 99, people had given up our mining for dead. And I was a mining analyst. I was a mining fund manager, so I had to stay in mining. And it was a great year. The mining unit trust did really well. Only Allen Gray and Oasis managed to beat the index and all the mining funds, of course. And I was lucky. Mine did very well that year. And people said, good job, Major. You made a recovery. You were number one again. And I said, you know what? I worked a lot harder than anybody thinks. Do you know why? 20 to 25% of my fund, I put into small caps trying to help the guys, you know, trying to do my bit to promote small mining. And Alec, that 20, 25% of my fund, I analyzed it at the end of the year. Do you know how much it rose? Because my fund did 131% that year. That small cap section of my fund, 20, 25% of it, rose about 26%. You know, it killed me. It was a freaking anchor and it just about killed me. So you can imagine how hard I had to work to make the other 75% do 160, so my average. And that's been my most important lesson on the small caps. I think I had six or seven of them in there, and they were good guys. I didn't think they were scam artists, but they just couldn't get it together, and the big companies could. So buyer beware. Small caps are not for orphans, widows, and people borrowing money.
I was also reading this morning that Socrates said that the beginning of wisdom is wonder. And what he meant by that was that wonder is when you look at something and say, wow, I didn't know that. And his view was that the more you realize that you don't know, the more you will start becoming wise. So thank you, Peter. Always my favorite time of the week where we get together and have a chat. I know you're traveling this week, so we've done it a little earlier, but we'll be back again next Wednesday. Peter Major is with Modern Corporate Solutions. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.